Welcome to another episode of The Suspendables with funny man Jungle Jim Jerome and retired NHL star Russ Cortinel.
Here's Cortinel.
Each week they unleash their raw, stripped down, unfiltered opinions on all things hockey and maybe other stuff too. Who knows? Inside stories, absolutely. Outrage, guaranteed. Offside, for sure. And always plenty of laughs. Strap in. The Suspendables is coming at you right now.
Well, I always end up laughing at the beginning of every episode of The Suspendables. Hi again, everybody. It's Jungle Jim coming at you with another episode of The Suspendables, but it's a big one. And it's show 99. Might be the worst kept secret ever. Okay? Might be the worst kept secret ever. I tried to fool you. I thought it would be Aaron Judge. Mark Gastineau. Okay? I could keep going back and back and back. But I'm really excited. I'm really excited about this because Russ is not here. No, that's hurtful. Rusty couldn't do it. He's probably building a 5,000 square foot addition on his house out of White Claw beer cans. You know, he could probably build 10,000 square feet. Rusty was unavailable, but we couldn't. The show must go on, and we're super pleased that we recorded this and able to put it up this week. Of course, you got to earn your nickname, as people always say. And he says, "This is Wayne Gretzky, the great one, coming up." And this, of course, is show 99. Enjoy. It, of course, with great anticipation, we've been talking about what are we going to do for show 99. Okay. That should be enough of a hint for someone. So we're really pleased to be joined by Aaron Judge with the New York Yankees.
I'll show you my age, Jimmy. I would have said Mark Gastineau, the New York Jets.
I was going to say that too, you know, or like Warren Sapp. Remember those guys back in the day?
Oh yeah, that was my generation.
Did they ever phone you? Of course, we're talking to Wayne Gretzky. Thanks a lot, Gretz, for coming on.
Yeah.
And any of those guys ever phone you? They're after you and say, "Hey, can I wear 99?
No, nor should they. Hey, listen, gosh, it's an honor to have your jersey retired. I get letters from kids. Is it okay if I wear number 99 on my Pee Wee hockey team? And I'm always, of course, I think it's great.
Yeah.
And then I saw that some people were disappointed that the pitcher in Toronto, he chose number 99. And I'm like, who cares? It's baseball. It's a different sport. He should have it. He should have the number he wants. That's great.
Yeah, cool. We found you yesterday. Now you're out of the dentist chair, right? You were getting a wisdom tooth pulled. Holy man, you're okay?
Yeah, I'm fine. A lot tougher being retired than it was playing. Yeah. You know, it's funny, when I was playing, when I was 10, my parents, who had no money, spent like $900 on these braces that I had to wear for 2 years. And I got my braces taken off.
Yeah.
And about a month later, I got my front four teeth knocked out accidentally. A kid fell and stick came down and knocked my mouth guard off and knocked my teeth out. Just horrendous 2 years in a dentist chair, putting in fake teeth and caps, and developed a huge fear of the dentist. But amazingly, I never wore a mouth guard after that. And I never lost another tooth.
You're kidding. Wow.
Yeah. My whole career. No, granted, I didn't block a lot of shots, so my teeth were pretty safe. I wasn't like Kevin Lowe falling in front of shots at every angle. That wasn't part of my makeup.
Right.
But I didn't feel too bad about it because Paul Coffey didn't do it either. And I figured, he's a defenseman. If he's not doing it, I'm not doing it. Yeah, I never lost another tooth, which is crazy.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what game was it when you got your first tooth knocked out? So you were just a kid then when
I was 10 years old. I'll never forget. I came off the ice and my teeth were on the blue line. They stopped the game to see if they could go get them. And two of them were cut in half. So the nerve was still alive. And every time I took a breath, felt like a knife went through my mouth. But
no kidding.
My dad, in all his wisdom, in the locker room after the game, he said, "Let me see," and I opened my mouth. And the only thing I can remember that he said was, "Well, now you look like a real hockey player." And I'm thinking, okay, great. I got no teeth. I look like a hockey player. My mom was so mad because she had spent all this money on an orthodontist. And all for naught, because I ended up getting my front four teeth knocked out. But it was kind of funny at the time.
Yeah, like all the, you know, your name's always in the records, right? There's the second generation of kids has come along now, right? You retired in 99, and now you've got, you know, the other day I saw they're talking about Sid the Kid now has got, I don't know, 16 or 17 years in a row with a point a game.
Yeah.
Ovi there, they keep talking about you. He's 2,000 goals behind you, but they're talking about him setting a record. One of the records should be, Gretzky, you bring it up, is if a guy never got his teeth knocked out. That should be a record if someone that ever happened with a hockey player.
It's different now, you know. We used to have this sort of image of the game of hockey. And I really noticed that when I went to LA originally, that it had this image of, okay, if you're an NHL hockey player, you had to have had all your teeth knocked out, one. And number two, if you're a Canadian hockey player, then you have to be bilingual. You should be able to speak French.
Right, right.
That was sort of the criteria of what people sort of thought of NHL players from Canada. But today's game, the kids at age of five, they wear a full shield. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's tough for them to get teeth knocked out. Most of them wear a full shield until they're 18, and then they go to the half shield. So I would venture to guess there's fewer teeth that are being left on the ice than in my era. It's a little bit different.
Gretz, it's been a tough year for you. There's no doubt about it. We had you on for the 50th show. So I think it was May 18th or something. I was looking back, and I think just before that, Joey died. I think just has it been over a year, I guess, since Joey Moss died already?
Pretty close. Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, our condolences, Gretz, about your father. That was, you know, I don't know what to say when that happened. I've lost mine, and lots of people have. And your relationship with your dad, Gretz, I bet hands down in history, it's got to be the most public father-son relationship there ever was.
Yeah, probably.
When you think back, Gretz, did you know that was going to happen with your dad? Did you look at this thing and say, okay, Dad, your life's going to change remarkably? You know, as you go forward?
No, I think he was so wise. I think it was more him telling me that my life was going to be different, and that the future for Wayne Gretzky was going to be pretty unique. So his wisdom was really strong. Mm-hmm. You know, like most kids, you know, you have this relationship with your parents. Your parents are your sort of guidance in life, and at times you have to be strict and at times you have to be tough, because that's how you learn sort of discipline and work ethic and responsibility. And that's a sort of the role of a parent. And then there comes a point in your life where that sort of ends. The teaching from a parent is sort of, they've done all the teaching they can do. Mm-hmm. And then you become best friends. And I'm sure you had that with your dad, that, you know, you go from being sort of that child that is being sort of coached endlessly and guided endlessly to becoming best of friends. And so I was lucky. Sometimes people become best friends with their parents at teenage years or early 20s, and sometimes not even until they're in their 30s. But, you know, my life was relatively on a fast track when I turned pro at 17. So I left home at 14. So our friendship and our relationship as best friends developed probably maybe even a little bit earlier than other people. We got to travel the world together. We had so many great memories together. I often tell the story. He was such a unique man. That I went home one time to visit, and periodically I'd just pop in, and I wouldn't tell him, because if I told him I was coming, it was like Mardi Gras. There would be 100 people at the house. And he loved to, you know, have people come over and get pictures and autographs. And that was fine. That was part of who he was. And I didn't mind it. But every now and then I like to sort of sneak in without anybody knowing. And my mom wouldn't tell him that I was coming. And all of a sudden I would show up. And he couldn't wait to get to a telephone to call people to come to the house. But I knew we had a good 6 or 8 hours alone. But one time I walked into the house and there was a guy lying on our couch. And I remember periodically people would be at the house, and that was kind of the norm at our place. But I went into the kitchen. I said to my mom, I said, "Who is that guy on the couch?" She goes, "Oh, that's so-and-so from Newfoundland. He's hitchhiking across the country, and he stopped at the house to see the basement. And your dad told him to get a couple good meals and spend the night and have a shower." So nobody had any idea who he was, but this gentleman from Newfoundland was sleeping on my couch. I said, "Geez, I'm surprised he's not wearing my Oilers jersey as a night shirt."
That's funny. Later on, it was probably me back in my days.
You and Glenn.
Yeah, right. Let's talk about the basement thing for a minute now that you bring it up, because people, we've heard all sorts of crazy stories, right, about just strangers showing up at your house, and everyone goes, "Well, no, that can't be the case," and that your dad would welcome them with open arms and then take them down to that shrine. Was that is that really the case? Was that true?
Yeah, it was 100% true. I can't tell you how many people I've run into. NHL players, ex-NHL players, fans, business people, celebrities who have said, "You know, when I was a kid, I stopped at your dad's house and your mom and dad took me in the house and took me downstairs and I put some of your jerseys on and I got pictures taken." It was part of his life. He absolutely genuinely loved people getting an opportunity to be able to see exactly what he had down there. Now, my dad never collected anything to sell. That was, you know, if people know my dad, he's pretty simplistic. He was a blue collar guy that worked at Bell Telephone. But from the time I was 6 years old, he started collecting my first jersey, my first hockey jacket, my first trophy, all the way to the very end, winning my last trophy and my last jersey. That was just something he loved doing. And he loved for people to be able to participate and be part of it. It just was genuinely out of kindness and the good of his heart. Mm-hmm. So as fun as that was for my dad, sometimes the bus would pull up. It would kind of send my mother over the edge. Sure. And she would sort of run out the door and probably go up to her friend's place for a glass of rye just to get out of the house, if you know my mom.
Sure,
and so, sure. But all in all, she was a trooper too. But I think my favorite story, though, about my house was that people would stop at the house. And for people who don't know my dad, he wasn't a handyman as far as he didn't trim the bushes or he wasn't concerned about the outside look of the house, cutting the grass, but he always had the greenest, thickest grass you can ever imagine. And people would stop and say, "Walter, we just want to know what you're putting on that grass. We can't get our grass as green as yours." And my dad would tell them, "It's just real simple. In December, you put a sprinkler head out there and you let it go back and forth. You build an ice rink about 5 inches thick and you're going to have the most beautiful green, thick grass you've ever had." And people would not believe him that he was telling the truth. And we would always say, "He's not lying." I don't think my dad knows where you can get seed for grass. That wasn't part of his makeup. All he cared about was building the best hockey rink he could build. And in the summertime, he would have the greenest grass you can ever imagine.
That's hilarious, man.
Yeah. People would come and they would cut pieces of the grass and put it in bags and take off. they were going to analyze it. My mom and I would be in the living room and we would just start laughing. We thought it was very comical, but people genuinely thought my dad had this secret recipe to how to make green, thick grass. And we used to just get a big chuckle out of it. That's so funny. That was actually more fun for my mom and I than the basement, actually.
Yeah, no kidding, Matt. I never knew that story.
Yeah.
Gretz, when he, of course, when your dad had his aneurysm, you know, I mean, I can't imagine. I remember that day, actually, because Glenn and I were living together, your brother. And, you know, it's just terrible news. And when your dad died, you know, the people were the outpouring of love, and of course, for your dad. And people were trying to sort of capture what he meant, Walter. And I remember sending out a text. I said, well, here's what I know about Walter. You know, he was a great guy when I met him. And then he had this aneurysm. No one knew what was going to happen. As far as I can see, after he had it, he just spent the rest of his life every single day doing charity work.
Yeah.
Do you think it flipped a switch, Gretz, when he had the aneurysm or something in him?
Yeah. Well, let me say this. When he had his aneurysm, you know, for people who don't know, my dad was a heavy smoker. He never drank, but he smoked cigarettes. Probably from stress and cigarettes is a huge cause of heart attacks and brain aneurysms. And it was probably a downfall from everything. Mm-hmm. So when he had his brain aneurysm, he was 9 days in a coma and I think 2 or 3 6 or 7 hour surgeries to his brain. And then ultimately about 4 years of going through clinical rehabilitation, two and a half or 3 years in a clinic, actually. Mm-hmm. And then he sort of started to come out of it in the sense that, you know, he started getting a little bit physically and mentally more normal. And then to a point where in about 1995, he got comfortable again of being who he was. And unfortunately, when he was passing, it was 20 days that we spent there. We spent the first 9 days, obviously, in tears and crying and understanding that, you know, it was near the end. He was such a huge, great man of faith that we were very comfortable where he was, but he had a passion and a love for life and didn't want to leave. So we spent the last 9 days thinking, gosh, you know, you've done everything you can, your body is shut down, you know, go to where you need to go. And finally, after about 20 days of no food and water, he passed along peacefully. And there was about 20 of us in there with the siblings and grandchildren. And I was telling the grandchildren that, you know, they only knew my dad after his aneurysm. So basically from 95 on, and Paulina and Kayla would be the oldest two grandchildren, Keith's daughter, Kayla. And none of them knew my dad. And I hadn't really realized that until we were at the house, that these kids never knew their grandfather before his aneurysm. And I started telling them things of his different way of life. It wasn't extremely different, but it was different. His loves and his passions changed. For people who knew my dad before his aneurysm, he couldn't go without watching a hockey game that I was playing in or my brothers were playing in. He never went anywhere without a camera, and he hated to play golf, and he loved to fish. And after his aneurysm, he gave up fishing, loved to golf, and never picked up a camera. So his interests changed, and his personality changed a little bit. He was obviously a lot more outgoing and a lot more comfortable with who he was as far as being out there in the public eye. He was a lot more shy before his aneurysm. And a lot of times would be extremely happy to sort of be in the background. But, you know, we always say things happen for a reason. his purpose in life was to sort of make people aware of less fortunate people. His sister was mentally challenged, and every day for 25 years, every Sunday for 25 years, he picked up this little blind boy that lived across the street and took him to church every Sunday, and took him to coffee and Tim Hortons after church. And he was very proud of that, and he loved doing that. So he was always the same person. It was just that after his aneurysm, he became more outgoing. And I was telling my grandchildren that you guys are kind of lucky that you got him after his aneurysm, because he would have been a lot tougher on all you guys before his aneurysm.
Right.
I thought that was funny.
Yeah.
You know, it was an amazing few weeks. I said, gosh, people in the community, and that's Canada, you know, every single night somebody was bringing us over dinner for 25 people. I said, gosh, if he hangs in there any longer, I'm going to have to go from here to a fat farm. it was nice to sit around for those days and just tell stories. And I hadn't been in Brantford for more than 2 days since I was 14 years old. So to be able to spend 20 days there, and it was unique because when I went through customs, they said, you know, Mr. Gretzky, you got to quarantine for 14 days. I said, no, that's no problem. When I go home, I don't leave the house anyway. So
right, right.
It was no big deal for me. But it was nice. We all got to stay together. And then, you know, when we started talking about the service, like everyone else that's gone through this COVID, there's guidelines, and we were putting together the preparation of the funeral. And all we kept saying as a family was, we can't do anything that nobody else can do, because our dad would be so mad that he got to do something that somebody else couldn't. So, you know, there was guidelines and we followed them. And for part of the part reasons, it was great that it was just private and it was just our family that got to be there and got to sort of be saying goodbye to him. Mm-hmm. And then the other side of it was, we probably could have filled Maple Leaf Gardens to do a service for him, because he had no enemies and people loved talking to him and loved being around him.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I was lucky enough to experience that with your dad. And I think I had him fooled, because me and your brother Glennie lived together, and it was kind of organized chaos, you know, when we were roommates.
No.
Yeah. Well, yeah. We had to turn to you to look after us a few times. Yeah. And I remember Walter coming, saying to me, after his aneurysm, saying to me, thank God, Jimmy, for you, because you're helping Glenn so much. I said, I don't think so, Wally. You know, I don't think so. But
he hadn't got all his nerve endings back in his brain yet.
You talked about Walter and his grandchildren, and now you're a grandfather with Dustin and Paulina, and your son Ty now, right? He got married, of course, more than a year ago. And are they're expecting their first child now?
Yeah, it's amazing about Ty is that the last week of February, I guess 2019, we were walking down the street in Manhattan. They were getting married in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And this gentleman was working for I think a bank company. I can't remember exactly. But he was from Sault Ste. Marie. He was about 30 years old, and he stopped me on the street to get a picture. And I said, yeah, no problem. And we took a picture. It was probably February 26th, 3 days before the wedding, because I got married on, my son's so smart, he got married on February 29th. So he only has to buy a present every 4 years.
Anniversary, right?
Yeah. He's way brilliant. Smarter than I am. Yeah. And he took the picture, and we were talking about the two Greyhounds and Sault Ste. Marie. And he said to me, just be careful of this pandemic. And now listen, I don't profess to be from Harvard, but I actually said to him, well, what is a pandemic? And he said, Wayne, this is not going to be good. This is going to be really something that people aren't going to believe. And here was this 30-year-old guy from Sault Ste. Marie telling me this. Consequently, as we know, the last year and a half has been horrible for everyone as far as the pandemic goes. Mm-hmm. And I remember leaving there when we left Manhattan. My mother-in-law is 99 and my dad was 81. They flew in Friday. We did the wedding Saturday. They flew out Sunday. No one got sick. But right after that, the pandemic hit. And I said to Ty the other day, I said, gosh, you guys might have had one of the last big weddings in Manhattan since 2019.
Yeah, sure.
We had 300 people there and married a great girl. And yeah, they're expecting a little girl. So we had two boys and one little girl on the way. That's exciting, you know. My dad would have loved being around them. They fish a lot. They love to fish with their dad. Their dad, when he doesn't have tournaments and he has downtime, one of his passions is fishing. I said to him, we went fishing about 2 months ago in Florida and spent 6 hours on a boat. And I said, fishing with you is just like fishing with my dad. Everybody talks a big game and we never catch anything. I said, at least with my dad, we had one little pole that was made out of birch. And I said, you got 8 poles in the water and we're not even getting a bite.
That's so funny. That's why it's called fishing. Otherwise, it would be called catching, as they say.
Well, we definitely didn't catch anything other than I caught some sort of sun disease because it was 100 degrees.
Jesus, man. Dusty's a big fisherman, isn't he?
Yeah, he loves it. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's his forte. Him and his brother both, they love to fish. He spear fishes, which is crazy to me. He'll dive in and... I was with them in the Bahamas one time. And next thing I know, they're shooting fish and blood is everywhere. And there must have been 30 sharks within 5 feet of us in 10 seconds. I jumped out of that water and never went back in.
But
that's his vice. He loves to fish. I was never a fisherman, you know. Craziest thing, it was one of those things when you're a kid and my dad would say, we're going fishing. And I looked at my mom and I would almost be in tears. And finally, my mom said, you got to tell him. And about the age of 11, I remember I said to my dad, I'm not going fishing today. I hate it.
Yep,
I think I killed my dad that I told him I didn't want to fish. It's one of those things, either you love to fish or you don't. And it's not my thing. My two grand boys, they could fish all day. They love it. They're 4 and 6. And gosh, that's one of the things they love to do. But good for them.
Yeah. Are they swinging a club, by the way?
Yeah. They're obviously, they're pretty good athletes. People don't know this, but Dustin's grandfather, who was his mother's father, actually played basketball for the LA Lakers a little bit. And so the sort of tree line is pretty athletic in our family. So the two boys are pretty athletic. I think the little guy, the 4-year-old, is much more into it than the 6-year-old. And the 4-year-old's a lefty. So he can get out there and play every day that Dustin takes in the 4-year-old. But the older one, you know, they find their way. And he's very athletic, but he doesn't quite have the same passion as his younger brother.
Speaking of good genes, when you bring that up, when you think of a child of Dustin Johnson's and a Gretzky, yeah, they got a good shot here. They got a good shot.
I hope they stay off skates, so it's too physical.
Tell me what the rest of your kids, Gretz, I guess, to catch up. Where are you spending all your time now, Gretz? There was rumor that your house was up for sale. Everyone saw that. It was very public. Where are you living now? What's your plan now?
We decide to move out of California. Mostly because after my dad passed on, we have a house in St. Louis, and my mother-in-law is 99 and a half, she'll be 100 in August, and our kids are all getting older and sort of moving on in their lives. So Jen and I kind of felt like, you know, let's go to St. Louis and spend time there and be around family. She has, unfortunately, two sisters that have passed away in the last few years of breast cancer, and she has a sister here and some nieces and two brothers and her mom, obviously. So I love St. Louis, and we've had a house here for over 10 years, and it's an enjoyable place for me. I got a lot of friends here. And then we summer in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, which we've been for about 12 years. I love it there. It's a place to we can boat a little bit and play golf and hang out as a family. It's a place that we sort of all congregate to. Ty and his wife Sarah and Trevor and Tristan and Emma, and then of course Dustin and Paulina. And if Dustin's kind of got a busy schedule in the summer, the grand boys will come up for 3 or 4 weeks and spend the time with us while he's playing and going to Europe and British Open and stuff like that. So it's a great family place for us. And I'll tell you, a lot of Albertans there, probably as many Albertans in that area as there is in the rest of North America, who people that are from Edmonton and Calgary. So yeah, it's a wonderful place, and we really enjoy it.
Cool. And what about Tristan Gretz? Is he playing golf, or what happened with COVID? Because he's shown a lot of promise as a golfer. Yeah, I've seen him hit it.
You know, the world is different today. When you were 19 or 20 and took a year off in our era, people thought that was the end of the world, right? But in this day and age, he decided to take a year, partly because of COVID and partly because he wanted to change. And so he hasn't really decided what his next move is as far as what university and where he wants to play golf. But you know what? Listen, life is there's a lot of steps in life, and you just have to have a passion for whatever you do. And that's what we try to tell our kids. We don't have all the answers, but just love what you're doing. Get your education and try to be nice to people, and it goes a long way.
Right on. You know, I was saying earlier that this is the next generation of players, you know, who started after you did in 99. They're talking about all these records, and Ovi, about goals. Will he be able to do it if he plays till he's 65 or whatever he's going to do? One of them that came out yesterday, I was watching the game, and I want to ask you about the Oilers and your thoughts on all this, the way they pulled this off the NHL. One of them was yesterday, Gretz, was the 25-year anniversary of the last game played in the original Winnipeg Jets building. Right. And if I get one email a week, Gretz, I get 10 from Winnipeg people saying, you know, Wayne was actually supposed to play for Winnipeg. Right. And I always go, well, I don't know that, but I've heard that, you know, from time to time. And I, of course, knowing you were coming on, I said, I better ask you what's the whole story there, Gretz? Because a lot of Winnipeggers say that they were an inch away from you ending up playing there.
Yeah. So when I was 17, I signed with Indianapolis, and that time the WHA. They thought this 17-year-old kid was going to come in and be a savior and lead a team to a championship and sell tickets in a city that wasn't at that time a great hockey market. And the reality was I was probably way too young and wasn't sort of qualified at the time. And Nelson Scalabrine, who was the owner of the team who had signed me and who to this day I still talk to, and we have a great relationship and big reason why my life is what it is today, because he helped change it and made it for the better. So, we played one of our last games as Indianapolis. I was playing in Winnipeg. Mm-hmm. And it was about my seventh game as a racer. And after the game, the locker room boy came up to me and said, Wayne, Bobby Hall wants to meet you by the Zamboni and take you for dinner. And I said, oh, my God. Well, of course. So I raced the shower. I really didn't play a whole lot, and I really didn't play that well. I probably didn't even need the shower. So I got dressed and met Bobby, and we went to dinner. And at dinner, he was with a guy named Michael Gabbati, who was part owner of the Jets, or the majority owner at the time. And he said to me, you know, Wayne, you can prolong my career, and you remind me of Ulf Nilsson, that used to be my center here, that went to New York. I want to get you to Winnipeg, and you can be my center. And when Bobby Hall's telling me that, I'm sitting there going, well, great. Okay, of course. And about 4 days later, I was in Indianapolis, and Nelson came and met with me and said, I'm going to trade you, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, I understand. And it was the right thing to do. And from his point of view, I think it was the proper thing to do. He said, you're going to go to Winnipeg or Edmonton. I haven't decided yet. And I said, okay. He said, do you have any preference? And I said, well, geez, tough I don't choice. Know. I've never been to your place, really. I've been to Winnipeg once and never been to Edmonton. And so I called my agent at the time, Gus Bedali, and I said, hey, you know, told him the story. And Gus said, well, if he asks you again, recommend Edmonton. And I said, okay, but why Edmonton? And he said, well, they have a 16,000-seat arena. And if there's any kind of merger with the NHL, they have a leg up and they have a better chance to get in the NHL than Winnipeg does. And I said, okay, I'll tell him that. So I told him that, but he still hadn't decided. We got on a plane and we were going to go from Indianapolis to Minnesota, stop in Minnesota and either go to Winnipeg or go to Edmonton. And we got to Minnesota. The pilot said, we're going to go to Edmonton. And that's when I really found out I was traded to Edmonton. I guess what it transpired at the time, the general manager of the Winnipeg Jets was a guy named Rudy Pillis. And Rudy Pillis wasn't sure I could play professional hockey. He was unsure of my size. He was unsure if I was fast enough. And basically said, I don't think it's a good deal for the Jets. And I good ended one. Up in Edmonton. And Bobby Hull was, to this day, him and I giggle about it and laugh about it. And every now and then he goes, well, I didn't laugh too long. That's kind of funny. Yeah. And that's the true story. And that's exactly what happened. And, you know, listen, Rudy Pillis, I understand. Here I was, 17 years old. I played 7 games and really hadn't accomplished anything. I can understand where he's coming from. But I really admired and respected Bobby Hull just coming to a 17-year-old kid and saying, you can play and you can prolong my career. It was nice to hear.
Right. Gretz, you got to tell the story about what, like you were in high school or supposed to be anyway back then. And wasn't there a story about the principals looking at your attendance record and going, I need to speak to this kid?
Yeah. So June of, I guess, 78, I signed. I was 17, and to legalize the contract, my dad had to sign it. And my dad said to me, look, I'll sign it, but you have to stay in high school till you turn 18. When you turn 18, I don't care what you do. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting here thinking, look, I just got offered all this money. And at the time, I was getting a $250,000 signing bonus. And I'm looking at my dad. We were, you know, by no means had any money. And he was still holding out saying that principle was more important than financial. And I looked at him and I said, okay, I'll stay in school until I'm 18. Now, Indianapolis was a little bit easier. We didn't travel as much. It was more centrally located. So when I got to Edmonton, I had to go to high school in Edmonton. I think I went to Ross Shep, I believe.
Right.
And it was tough because the Oilers were going 14-day road trips and come home. And of course, I didn't really go to school that lot, a whole lot. When I did go, Jimmy Nielsen, my teammate, I would pick up his daughter at their house because they lived around the corner from where I was living with Glenn and Ann Sather. And we would go to school together, go to class, and then I'd leave and go to practice or play a game that night. So I got called in one day by the principal saying, you know, you're going to make nothing of yourself. You're never in class. I'm going to have to kick you out. And it was early January of that year, 79, I guess. And I said, listen, I turn 18 on January 26th. If it doesn't improve by then, call me in and I'm done. He said, okay, I'm giving you one more chance. So January 26th came. I went into his office and I said, you know what? Thanks. Thanks for not kicking me out. I'm done school. But in those days, you know, as big as the Oilers were, it wasn't the NHL. And I was kind of a little bit under the radar still somewhat. Mm-hmm. And I think by then, though, when I went in there, he knew where I was. But, you know, he couldn't have been nicer. The fact that he could have thrown me out of my ear and he was nice enough to keep me there.
Yeah, cool. Gretz, what are your thoughts on the NHL this year, pulling this thing off? You know, everyone, when it started and they came up with this idea of a North Division because of protocols, of course, and restrictions. And everyone was going, this is going to be the most fantastic thing ever. I know you watch a bunch of hockey and I've been watching it, and everyone thought it would create great rivalries and all that stuff. And after a while I looked at it and go, okay, they're playing that team again.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on the whole thing, Gretz, in this Northern Division, for example? Is it, you know, people are saying we should do it down the road. What do you say?
First of all, I'm totally enamored by what the players have accomplished, playing in front of no fans, playing with the intensity that they're playing, following the protocol that they have to follow. I mean, they're basically, especially the teams in Canada, they're under somewhat of a house arrest. Mm-hmm. So they basically go to the rink, they go home, they get on a bus, they get on an airplane, they go to a hotel, they go to the rink. And to keep that intensity level up over a long period of time is really, really difficult. As a professional athlete, you really feed off the energy of the fans, whether they're cheering you or you're on the road and you're getting booed. I'm so impressed by the level of competition that we've seen. For a one-year trial, I think it's been great. We have a North Division. Who knows? We might have to do it for a second year. But I think the fans, all in all, have really enjoyed it. But, you know, I'm truly amazed with the pandemic that we've gone through and how difficult it's been for families and for people. I think that to be able to turn the TV on and be entertained for a couple hours, watch your favorite hockey team or watch a rivalry of teams that play. So I my hat goes off to not only the elite players who are playing at a high level, but all the players and coaches and staff that are part of it. And to see what guys like Connor is doing and Austin Matthews and Leon, Nathan McKinnon, Colorado. I think it's been tremendous. And listen, we're all looking for some ray of sunshine. We're all looking for some sort of, okay, how can I put a smile on my face tonight? And I think those hockey players have done an incredible job of trying to bring some normalcy to people's lives.
Right. It's amazing. So, put COVID aside, Gretz, this pandemic. What about that Northern thing? What do you like it? Is it too much? Is it, you know, weighted too much on a bunch of teams playing each other, or do you see something that maybe it is interesting to have that down the road?
No, I think it's been good. I think it's been great for the excitement of fans in Canada. I think it's been good for the National Hockey League. Ultimately, I don't know when it's going to change, but it's going to change. And the only reason, and listen, I don't have a crystal ball, but the travel becomes such a burden. And for Edmonton, especially in Vancouver and Calgary, it becomes so much easier to travel to Seattle and Vancouver and Anaheim and San Jose than to have to go across to Ottawa, Montreal, Toronto all the time. So eventually it's going to change. I'd be shocked if it didn't. Mm-hmm. But only because of the structure, the fact that travel becomes an issue. But I think for this year and maybe even next, we might do it again next year if things don't change in Canada. I think it's been great for the fans, and they're going to look back at it one day and go, wow, this is pretty cool. And tidbit fact, years ago when the WHA was trying to survive, and I'm not sure exactly what year it was, might have been 75 or 76, they did do a Canadian division. Mm-hmm. I think it was Ottawa, Winnipeg, Calgary, Quebec City. And it lasted like a year, maybe 2 years. And then that kind of went wayward too. But this is not the first time we've had a Canadian division in professional hockey.
Cool. Some years ago, someone sent me a picture the other day of me and Steve Warren used to do a morning show. You were on it a bunch of times. Mm-hmm. When we did the Ottawa morning show, and you showed up one day and did the whole show with us for 2 hours out in front of the Senators rink. Uh-huh. And Stevie's always said it was the greatest day of his life in radio. We're going to get him to come in and ask you a question in a second. He's producing this show. Before we do that, Gretz, Patrick Marleau kind of snuck out of nowhere. With the amount of games that he played to beat Gordy, I guess. Right. With the consecutive amount of games that he played. And it was an incredible record. And then people start talking about the Hall of Fame. So when you look at people who are getting into the Hall of Fame, Gretz, is there, in your mind, is there minimum requirements for it? Or who should be allowed in? What do you have to accomplish to get into the Hall of Fame, in your mind?
Oh, gosh. That's way over my head, Jimmy. I'm not part of the Hall of Fame. I would recommend people to go in the Hall of Fame, and guys that who aren't in, I would say, gosh, I'm shocked that guy's not in. Mm-hmm. But each and every guy that does get in, I'd be the first guy to shake their hand. I think it's great for the sport, and they should be proud of that. The criteria has changed over the years. It used to be if you got 1,000 points, that kind of got you in, or if you got 500 goals, that was sort of a benchmark. And that's changed. Winning championships has always been part of it. You know, Kevin Lowe got in. He didn't have the biggest numbers, but winning 6 championships obviously is a forte and something really good. It's the greatest game in the world, and if you get in the Hall of Fame, I'll be the first guy to shake your hand. I would never, if somebody said to me, does that guy deserve to be in the Hall of Fame? I would say absolutely. Mm-hmm. I'll give you a great example. Ray Whitney was my stick boy. He won a Stanley Cup. He's got over 1,000 points. And do you think he should be considered for the Hall of Fame? Absolutely. He has good numbers. Mm-hmm. And he won a championship. So I don't know. I'm not in the meetings when they decide on players and decide on guys. So I don't know what they look at each and every year as a criteria.
Good answer. Yeah. Stevie, go ahead. And then we'll let you go, Wayne. Thanks.
Okay. Oh, already?
Oh, no.
I was going to ask Wayne, you know, it's hard to believe it's been over 20 years since your final game in Canada was actually where I am here in Ottawa. And I was wondering if there's any memories from that night in Ottawa that stay with you today.
I just talked about this the other day. I was doing a, can't remember what I was doing. I was actually doing a call with some people. And I said, you know, one of the greatest memories I had was the last game in Ottawa, Canada. Worst kept secret that I was going to retire. Right. But I wanted to be able to announce it back in New York because people have been so nice to me. But I was telling a story, one of the greatest days of my life when I retired. And for people who don't know this, in the NHL, on game day, there's generally 2 buses. A bus to leave the hotel that generally leaves for 7:30 game around 3:45. And then there's players that like to go a little bit later, and the bus leaves at 4:30. But in between that, you go downstairs and they have a room set up. You can have a piece of toast or a sandwich or a cup of coffee or hot tea or whatever you want before you get on the bus. And generally, it's about half and half. Half the guys go early and half the guys go on the second bus. And I always went early. I like to get to the rink early. And I always found if I get in the locker room, no, nobody could call me. I didn't have to talk to anybody. I could sit down and just get ready. Anyway, when I went down at 3:15 for coffee, the entire team was in there, players, coaches, trainers. And I remember, I still get emotional thinking about it, walking in and thinking, oh my God. And we just sat in there for a half hour telling stories and talking about the game, and talking about the league. And then we all got on one bus together. And I always said it was probably one of the greatest hours of my life. It was very emotional. It's still emotional to me to this day. That all the guys, Brian Leach was the captain, kind of him and a couple other guys that organized it. And as much of a thrill it was in Ottawa, my dad there and my family and my wife, that ride to the arena that day was pretty overwhelming and something I'll never forget.
Gretz, thanks a million, man. Rusty missed the bell because he was supposed to be here. I don't know what.
Probably selling property in Coeur d'Alene. I just read it's the hottest property in North America, and Rusty will no doubt financially gain from that.
Or he's putting an addition on his house, a 5,000 square foot addition. He's making it out of beer cans. Yeah, I know, Rusty. fantastic, Gretz. Thanks.
All right, love you.
Thanks a million. Love you too, man. Thanks a lot for coming on.
All right, thank you.
The Suspendables is a weekly podcast series featuring former NHLer Russ Courtnell and host Jim Jerome. Join us for new episodes available each Wednesday morning. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. We invite you to subscribe and review or share the show with your friends and followers. Check out our website today, thesuspendables.com.
Jimmy, go to bed.